This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Britain's parliament approves Syria airstrikes. Climate change delegates get to work. New research finds clues about preterm births. A new book explores the talent of Michael Jackson.
Michael learned that dance from a number of different sources, including himself, but specifically from a group of dancers.
Those stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. British lawmakers have approved a request from Prime Minister David Cameron to take part in airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria. Prime Minister Cameron appeared in Parliament to make his case, saying the airstrikes would be part of a wider strategy to overcome the militant movement. The request was approved Wednesday after 10 hours of often heated debate. The head of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, was opposed to the move. Mr. Corbyn said Mr. Cameron failed to convince almost anyone that ground forces would be able to take back Islamic State-held territory if the British airstrikes did manage to help the coalition gain the advantage over the militants. Ben Barry is a senior fellow for land warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He tells International Edition host Sarah Williams about concerns over a possible larger British military operation as happened earlier in Iraq.
Yes, there are the concerns, but I think the concerns that many Labour politicians have expressed, which have also been expressed by a small minority of Conservative members of Parliament, is they can't see how a Britain contributing to airstrikes over Syria is going to make a military difference, and they can't see a coherent British government strategy that moves the situation in Syria closer to some kind of conclusion and a peace deal. That's fundamentally their objections. It's not so much a specific objection that Britain's going to repeat its role in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And indeed, the government has made it very clear that it doesn't see British boots on the ground.
And what about coordination, certainly when you've got several countries being involved in this? You know, I would think there's a certain amount of concern about how this will eventually be organized.
Well, the British have subordinated all their forces to the US-led coalition, who, of course, are deconflicting their air missions with those of Russia. So I don't see that's a particular problem.
Ben Barry, senior fellow for land warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. NATO is bolstering Turkey's air defenses in the wake of last month's shootdown of a Russian plane by Turkish jets. The announcement comes as Russia and Turkey increase their military buildup on the Turkish-Syrian border, fueling fears of a new confrontation. Dorian Jones reports.
NATO's decision will likely be viewed as a diplomatic victory for Ankara. Ever since Turkish jets downed the Russian bomber that allegedly violated its airspace on the Syrian-Turkish border, Ankara has looked to its NATO partners for support. The decision coincides with Moscow boosting its military presence in Syria, which political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul's Süleyman Şah University says now poses a serious threat to Turkish forces.
They are sending the ship Moskva with S-400 anti-aircraft missiles, and probably they may retaliate. Turkey has no military means and power to counter the Russian action in the region without the help of the Americans and the others.
Along with the Moskva, Russia has deployed to Syria S-400 missiles, whose range extends well into Turkish airspace. Analysts say NATO is expected to send ships to the eastern Mediterranean, along with more warplanes to Turkey's Incirlik air base, close to the Syrian border. Ankara is increasing its deployment of fighter jets patrolling the Syrian border. Sinan Ülgen of the Carnegie Institute in Brussels says NATO's support will likely strengthen Ankara's stance against Moscow.
The feeling in Ankara is that Turkey had every right to do what it did. There will not be an apology issued by Ankara over this. And Ankara expects its partners in the West to support this position. If there is another violation, we can unfortunately expect a repeat of what's happened.
Despite NATO's claim its planned Turkish deployment is not against Russian forces, observers warn it will likely further hamper efforts to persuade Moscow to coordinate in the fight against Islamic State. Even with this latest developments, observers say the first sign of a possible easing of tensions could be the announcement that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will meet this week with his Turkish counterpart Mevlut Cavusoglu on the sidelines of an OSCE conference in Belgrade. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
The International Climate Conference continues in Paris, even though most of the heads of state from participating nations have departed. President Obama said those in attendance share a sense of urgency about their goal of curbing fossil fuel emissions and limiting the rise in global temperatures. And he cited some progress the United States and others have already made. Remaining in Paris is VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez, who tells International Edition host Susan Yaki about the work that remains for the delegates at the conference.
The delegates, now that the heads of state have gone home, have really gotten down to business. That is, they're talking about money, how they're going to finance much of what's being proposed here, much of what countries are committing to. This conference got off to quite a good start. That's according to the hosts of it. That being because, you had such a high concentration of world leaders, more than 150 of them, just giving the whole thing a push from the very beginning. Now comes the hard work of getting down to the details to see how exactly they would carry out the elements that are going to make up a final agreement that they hope to reach at the end of it.
The UN has been warning that failure to improve water resource management jeopardizes progress on a number of fronts, including poverty, sustainable development, that kind of thing. Have you heard any concerns about the water issues there?
That has been a central issue at this conference here. There's a great concern about droughts, floods, expanding deserts, problems with the availability of clean water. And this is something that has been very much on the agenda today, Wednesday, because some of the discussion is on how to better manage the water that that remains on the planet. One other topic of conversation, particularly yesterday, was on the receding levels at Lake Chad, where there is a strong connection between security and the environment there. Lake Chad, along the shores there, of course, has seen some attacks by the group Boko Haram. And that is just one example of many that's being discussed here.
One time I was in French Polynesia on an atoll, and the people there, this was a number of years ago, they were very concerned because you could see the water in the atoll, but you could also see the water in the ocean, and they were fearful that the two sides were going to meet and their island would be gone altogether, so it's a real issue.
That is very much a concern, that actually parts of some of these countries, largely in the South Pacific, are actually disappearing. This is as sea levels rise. That's why one of the big areas of concern as well is the issue of melting polar ice.
You know, there seems to be more optimism there this year than there has in previous meetings.
There certainly is, because there is such a drive, and it's a concerted drive, unlike previous years. We've seen these meetings they start, they finish without any conclusion. This time there was as I mentioned earlier, there was a great deal of momentum with so many world leaders. In fact, it was the largest gathering of world leaders ever on Monday and Tuesday, kicking this summit off. So there is that, and then there are also demonstrations around the world calling for faster, more decisive action, more action and less words. And so that's what the drive here is right now, to get that agreement out, get it signed, get it ready by the time the summit ends on the 11th of December.
VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez in Paris, speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. Less than 2 months before voters begin the process of choosing the next U.S. president, a new nationwide poll by Quinnipiac University shows billionaire real estate developer Donald Trump widening his lead among Republican White House contenders. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson to shed some light on Mr. Trump's continued popularity.
Definitely good news for Donald Trump in the latest Quinnipiac poll. He's at 27%. That leads the field, and by a widening margin at this point. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, is in at 17% in second place. And then we have 16% each for Ben Carson and for Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who also seems to be climbing up. Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, down at 5%. And Carson's kind of looking like the loser in this poll so far. He's been fading in a number of other surveys of late. He may be somewhat a victim of the new focus on terrorism in the wake of the Paris attacks. But Trump remains the unchallenged front runner at the moment, I would say.
We have called previous candidates and previous races Teflon because things don't stick to them. It just kind of fall off. And Trump has said what many people consider to be some outrageous things, and yet he continues to surge in the polls. He's definitely resonating with the base that he has and has been able to maintain this lead.
Even in this press release from Quinnipiac, the polling director, Tim Malloy, refers exactly to the point you're making and says he seems to be wearing Kevlar. No matter what happens, what he says, it doesn't seem to come back at him. Now, we've talked to a couple of political analysts in the last week or so, and also trying to get at the issue of why does Trump's appeal continue to resonate no matter what, and most of them seem to agree that there's just a sense, particularly among the conservative Republican primary goers, of anger and disappointment and frustration with Washington. And Trump, for them, for months now, has been their vehicle to vent this. And that shows no signs of abating. And so for the most part, it doesn't seem as though the many controversies that Trump gets involved in, whether it's claiming that thousands of people were celebrating the 9/11 attacks in New Jersey, which there have been no pictures produced of that anywhere. It's been pretty much debunked by all involved. It doesn't seem to have much impact on slowing Trump's momentum so far.
Trump, of course, is a very successful businessman. And, you know, being so brash, he still has that air of getting things done. And that seems to be something very important for people who are really fed up with what's going on in Washington.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, one of the people we talked to, Bill Galston at Brookings, made that point. He said, people have seen for years the dysfunction in Washington. They are looking for someone to come in and get things done to kind of cut through the partisan paralysis, if you will, that's been going on here for several years now. So I think that's part of the appeal that Trump has. Now, on the flip side of this, the New York Times has come out with a report that's quite interesting, saying that a lot of upper echelon establishment Republican Party officials are increasingly concerned that Trump continues to do so well. There's an active discussion among these folks. Do we try to stop Trump? How do we do this? What are the risks in doing that? Clearly, there's a fear now not only that if Trump becomes the nominee, that he might be a weak nominee to go up against Hillary Clinton. Other people, by the way, don't necessarily agree with that. But that is part of this fear. And not only could then the Republicans lose the White House, but they might also even lose control of the Senate because of the effect that Trump would have on what we call down-ticket races in the United States for Congress and the Senate. So apparently there's mounting concerns within the party. But it's kind of like they have a tiger by the tail right now, and he's calling the shots.
For more on the latest survey and what is happening in U.S. politics, check out Jim Malone's reports on our website at voanews.com or via the free VOA mobile app if you have a smartphone or tablet. Still to come, the genius of Michael Jackson. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
Look up in the sky. It's a bird. No, it's a plane. No, it's just another drone. Drones have become so popular in the United States, local governments are making up new laws just to deal with them. What's new is Amazon's plan to use their drones to deliver packages to homes and businesses all over the U.S. Amazon's Prime Air delivery system hopes to get packages weighing 2.25 kilograms or less to their customers in 30 minutes or less. The 24-kilogram drones will fly under an altitude of 121 meters from thousands of distribution centers all over the country. Amazon says the drones are equipped with sense and avoid technology, enabling the unmanned aircraft to, yes, sense, then avoid obstacles in its path. Amazon is waiting on final approval from the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration before officially launching their Prime Air service. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
This is VOA's International Edition. New information may someday help prevent preterm births, the world's number one killer of young children. VOA's Carol Pearson has details on the latest studies that may hold some important clues.
More babies and young children die because they're born preterm than from any other cause, according to Dr. Edward McCabe from the March of Dimes.
We've gotten some infectious diseases, diarrheal illnesses, malnutrition. Those have been going down, so we're making good gains there. But preterm birth, prematurity, has not been going down and in many countries has been increasing.
Globally, 15 million children are born prematurely each year. 1 million of them die, but others suffer lifelong disabilities, blindness, cerebral palsy, reduced intellectual ability, and more. 60% of preterm births occur in Africa and South Asia. The rate of preterm births in the U.S. has fallen to 11.5%, but that's still the highest rate of preterm births in any industrialized country. The March of Dimes has funded studies and set up centers to find ways to cut this rate. McCabe pointed out that scientists at Stanford University found a difference in the bacteria in women's vaginas that may be critical in the understanding of prematurity.
In Stanford, they found that women who delivered preterm had a different community of microorganisms than women who delivered term.
Another study shows women have healthier babies if they space their pregnancies by at least a year and a half. Former Surgeon General Regina Benjamin says this is critical.
A woman's body requires about 18 months to recover between pregnancies.
Less than 18 months between births increases the risk of prematurity, as does smoking. Getting good prenatal care, nutrition, and exercise cuts the risk. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Time now to check out what's trending online. Social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here to tell us about a change in the way people name their babies. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
So what's leading this change?
It's technology, including social media. Each December, Baby Center releases a list of top baby names for the year, and in 2015, you see more gender-neutral names, names from young adult fictions and video games, as well as Instagram filters.
How Instagram filters ever got involved, who knows?
Who knows?
Who would have thought? But first things first, tell us what Baby Center is and who the parents are.
Sure, it's a website for parents and parents-to-be, and a big chunk of this year's parents are millennials. And these guys are very social media savvy. But the top 10 baby names from both genders are still quite traditional.
Well, you can't get away from the good old traditions. What are the popular names now?
The most popular name for girls for 6 years in a row is Sophia. That's followed by Emma, Olivia, Ava, Mia, and Isabella. So the six most popular girl names this year all end with letter A. For boys, Jackson is the most popular name for the third straight year. It's followed by Aiden, Liam, Lucas, Noah, and Mason. But like I said earlier, names of Instagram filters like Lux and Ludwig are also gaining popularity. Lux is up 75% on Baby Center's list of boy names. And for girls, the name Juno, also an Instagram filter, is up 30%.
You mentioned names from young adult fiction too, right?
Exactly. Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, A Fault in Our Stars, you name it. The last book heavily influenced girl names. For example, the popularity of the name Hazel, the heroine in the fiction, climbed 52% this year. The millennials also love the names of authors of the young adult fictions. That includes Rainbow, as in Rainbow Rowell, who wrote Fangirl, and John from John Green, who wrote The Fault in Our Stars. And last but not least, I also want to mention that names of YouTube stars are also popular among the young parents. They include Kingsley, Cameron, and Bethany. That's all for me today.
Social media is certainly a big part of their lives. Thanks, G. You can follow her on our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA_IE and on her own account at Gabby Lee. That's Gabeeyelle. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. In a career spanning four decades, Michael Jackson became a global icon, selling more than 400 million albums, earning 13 Grammy Awards, and spinning dance moves that captivated the world. The legacy of the King of Pop is still being explored even now, 6 years after his death. MJ, the genius of Michael Jackson, is the latest work to look into the life of the child star and troubled man. Author Steve Knopperer says despite years of scandal and controversy, Michael Jackson's legacy will be his music. Here's VOA's Faith Lapidus.
Steve Knopperer spent 3 years interviewing more than 400 people who knew Michael Jackson, relatives, friends, record executives, and celebrities.
He was a genius on many levels, but the three key ones to me were his intuitive singing style, the way he put in those rhythms, and secondly, the way he innovated dance at a time when really there wasn't a lot of dance in pop culture. And then thirdly, his songwriting. I think he doesn't get enough credit for being a great songwriter.
Michael Jackson's rise to superstardom really began in the late 1970s when he started collaborating with legendary record producer Quincy Jones.
It really was Quincy bringing a whole team to the studio, and sometimes they worked on Michael's songs together, and other times he would bring in a prominent songwriter, Rod Temperton, who wrote Thriller and a lot of other great Michael songs.
And it was Thriller, released in 1982, that propelled Jackson across pop music's racial barriers.
It's close to midnight. Something evil's lurking in the dark.
Disco, which had been huge for 3 or 4 years, had just crashed. And so when Michael came along with Thriller, radio stations and MTV and other entities within the music business were segregated, you know, so it was black artists were on urban, quote-unquote, urban radio stations, and white artists were on either rock or top 40 or other kinds of radio stations. And so Quincy and Michael and their team, you know, specifically decided that they wanted to make music that was for everybody.
Collaborating with white musicians was another way to break the racial barriers in music. Jackson did that with former Beatle Paul McCartney on The Girl Is Mine, and 4 months later with heavy metal hero Eddie Van Halen.
The doggone girl is mine.
It was the way for Michael to, as an African-American artist, to kind of get onto white pop stations, if you will, using Paul McCartney.
Because the doggone girl is mine.
And once he was able to make that move, you know, all the rest of the songs followed. Later, of course, to get on white rock stations, they employed Eddie Van Halen.
One of Jackson's trademarks was his moonwalk dance, the famous glide that looks like he's moving forward and backward at the same time.
Michael learned that dance from a number of different sources, including himself, but specifically from a group of dancers. Their names were Casper Candidate and Cooley Jackson, and there was another guy named Jeffrey Daniel. He eventually invited a couple of these guys to come teach it to him directly. And I did an interview with Cooley Jackson, who kind of explained how Michael kept saying, I'm not getting it, I'm not getting it. It's a very difficult move to get, and it doesn't click until you work on it and work on it and work on it. And finally, it clicked, and Michael got it.
Jackson also showed that persistence in making sure the words and music clicked. Some of his best songs were years in the making, like Earth Song from the 1995 History album.
What about sunrise? What about rain? What about all the things that you said we were to gain?
Michael was a great balladeer, but Earth Song was one of his best and most complex ballads, and he used it in different ways. You know, he used it to sort of talk about saving the environment, to talk about saving the children, and it was a very adaptable anthem, and he really labored over this anthem and kept tinkering with it and tinkering with it over a period of 7 or 8 years, and finally he turned it into this big, bold anthem.
Author Steve Knopper says Michael Jackson's impact on pop music hasn't faded, even in death, and his legacy will fuel the music industry for generations to come. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Iran, Baha'is, who make up one of the country's largest non-Muslim religious communities, have been a target of persecution by the government for decades, and the persecution continues. Baha'i persons and property are routinely attacked with impunity. Baha'is are denied access to higher education unless they renounce their faith. They are barred from employment in the public sector. They may not inherit property, and they are disproportionately subject to arbitrary arrest. Over 70 Baha'is currently languish in prison because of their religious beliefs. In 2010, the seven leaders of the community were convicted of spurious security-related crimes and sentenced to 20 years, the longest prison sentence given to any prisoner of conscience in Iran. According to recent reports, on November 15th, at least 15 Baha'is were arrested in Tehran, Esfahan, and Mashhad. Reportedly, their families were not informed about their whereabouts or the charges they face. Recent reports also included scores of businesses belonging to Baha'is being shut down in several cities in the Manzandaran province, and authorities closing all Baha'i businesses in the city of Rafsanjan. In its most recent report on the state of religious freedom in Iran, the U.S. State Department noted that the Iranian government discriminates against and creates a threatening atmosphere for all non-Shia, most notably the Baha'is. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Iran, Ahmed Shahid, has detailed the abuses suffered by the Baha'i community and urged the Iranian government to end its practice of religious intolerance. As U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said, the freedom to profess and practice one's faith is a birthright of every human being.
Religious minorities, including those who profess no faith, should have the same rights as religious majorities. And that is a fundamental belief.
No nation can fulfill its potential if its people are denied the right to practice, to hold, to modify, to openly profess their innermost beliefs, said Secretary Kerry. We all have a responsibility to affirm our faith in the principles of religious freedom that the world community has endorsed so many times.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.